Make sure you've got Revelation 5 in front of you. And I wonder what you think the biggest question is. The biggest of all big questions. If you've got any children or if you know any children, you know that sometimes they'll ask you questions and you think, wow, that is a big question. Maybe you know the bit in the book Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where the author Douglas Adams imagines an incredibly advanced alien race who build the biggest computer ever to work out what the meaning of life is. And they leave it running for 1,000,000 years and they come back and ask it, what's the meaning of life? And it thinks and it says, 42. And of course then they ask it, well, what's the question? And he says, well, to find out the question, you're going to have to build an even bigger computer and you're going to have to leave it running for even more millions of years to work it out. It's as if the meaning of life is such a big issue, we don't even know what the question is we're asking. Yet the issue forces itself on us, doesn't it? Especially on a day like today when we remember the horrors of war and lives cut short. What does it mean? What does their sacrifice mean? Does it mean anything apart from being good for us? Does existence mean anything at all? Revelation, this book in the Bible, is written to address the biggest questions of all. It's a vision given to John, which by means of picture language and symbols speaks to those big issues. Now that way of communicating might seem strange to us when we start reading it and hear of all these sevens and 24s and fours and these creatures and angels, but actually communicating by use of symbols is still something we do today. Just take your favourite newspaper and turn to the political cartoon tomorrow and you will see the same thing going on. I saw one this week which was like it was a picture of a Statue of Liberty but drawn like Donald Trump and holding a swastika. Now, that's a combination of symbols. I don't know what they were trying to say, but you can imagine. That's a powerful combination of symbols. We still do that today. John's vision communicates with us in that kind of way. In fact, it's so powerful a way of talking that in some countries, if you create an image like that about your leader, you would be put in prison. We read chapter 5 in Revelation, and just before this bit, in his vision, John has seen a throne room. That's an obvious symbol, isn't it? A throne is the seat of power. In a monarchy, the throne room is the control center of the country. But what John sees is like a picture of the control room of reality. John sees God on the throne of the universe, and he sees around him four living creatures. Not like any animals we've seen, but kind of composite animals made up of different kinds that we find in our world. And they represent the natural world. And he sees 24 elders, 24 humans, representing humanity. So the picture is this, is God on the throne, controlling all of reality and arrayed around him, the natural world and humanity and all that he's made. It's a representation of the way that reality is, according to John's vision. Everything under the rule of God. He made it. That's where it all came from. He keeps it in existence. Because he is on the throne, things keep to running in the universe in a regular and an ordered way. It runs according to the laws of physics, as we would call them. But if chapter 4 was about reality, then chapter 5 that we're looking at is about history. And the drama of chapter 5 all revolves around this job to be done. The biggest task imaginable, which all of history hangs on. Which, if it is not done, will make history a gut-wrenching tragedy. But if it is done, will mean the sweetest of happy endings. And in John sees in chapter 5 someone who can do it. And I think chapter 5 is saying to us that the big question that supercomputer would have come up with for the meaning of life is this. Is he worthy? Is he, the one in this chapter, who is Jesus, which is who the whole book's about, is he worthy? Is he able to do it? And is he therefore worthy to be trusted and followed and lived for and worshipped? If he is not, then no one is. And I think John's vision would say to us that is a very bleak thought indeed. If he is, it is sweet music to our ears. Let's have a look at the details of what John sees and pick those things out. First thing I want to pick out is this job, the biggest task. Verse 1, I saw in the right hand of him who sat on the throne a scroll with writing on both sides. The scroll in the hand of the king, well, that is the king's decree. That's the king's law. That's the king's commands. The scroll in the hand of the king is his government policy. It's his manifesto. It is his plan. And in John's vision, this is God's throne. This is the center of reality. So this scroll is God's decree about history. This is the design for everything. This is the meaning of history, what it is all for, from beginning to end. You notice it is written on both sides. It's full up. It is comprehensive. All of the threads in history, from beginning to end, even the dark ones, are there, written on the scroll. What has happened in the drama of history isn't purposeless. It's not meaningless. It's not random. It's not accidental. That is what John's vision is claiming. Maybe you've seen the film Slumdog Millionaire. It opens with that scene from the Who Wants to Be a Millionaire show. And the question that comes on at the very beginning is this. Jamal Malik is one question away from winning 20 million rupees. How did he do it? A, he cheated. B, he's lucky. C, he's a genius. Or D, it is written. It is written, and that's how the film ends. It is written. The idea, it's fate, it's destiny. Well, is there anything written? Does the drama of the universe have a script or not? In John's vision, it does. But it's not an impersonal one. It's not fate, because the scroll is in the right hand of the one sitting on the throne. Not an impersonal force, but the personal design of the ruler God. And either that document exists, not an actual paper scroll, but what it represents, or it doesn't. Either there is a purpose or a meaning, or there isn't. But if it doesn't exist, then the implications are huge. If there's no one on the throne, if they have no scroll in their hand, if there is nothing written, there are no standards of good or evil, and no freedom. And here's how one writer put it just last week. Then there is no point in poetry and music and speech and love. All there is mud and silence. Mud and silence are big things to think about today, aren't there? What was there left 100 years ago when the guns were silent but mud? Mud and bodies. Was that it? Is that all there is? Well, not according to our Remembrance Day rituals. We hold a silence precisely because we think it did mean something. Because we think it's important that we never forget what it meant, their sacrifices made for freedom. That was a good thing in the face of an evil thing. If there is nothing written, there is no good and evil and no freedom. But we know that's not the case. We know it doesn't mean nothing. John's vision agrees. There is a ruler and he has a law and a plan in his hand. And it was from that conviction, that way of viewing the world, that men stood up to fight. George VI said in his speech, made famous by the film, "We can only do the right as we see the right and reverently commend our cause to God." Revelation 5, John's vision says our instincts are right. There is right and wrong, and it is worth standing up for, whatever the cost. But in John's vision, it is sealed. The scroll is sealed with 7 seals. That's just his way of saying it's completely sealed. We would say it's 100% sealed. It cannot be opened, but it needs to be opened. Otherwise, we will never know. The meaning of history will be inaccessible to us. Almost as if, it's almost as bad as if there were no meaning. We intuitively know there must be one, but for it to be forever out of reach. But also, if the scroll is not opened, the ruler's will can't be done. His plan can't be put into action. It can't be brought to completion. It must be opened. Someone must be found to open it. Verse 2. And I saw a mighty angel proclaiming in a loud voice, "Who is worthy to break the seals and open the scroll?" This is the biggest job. Who can do this? It's not just a matter of strength. This is a mighty angel who's calling out, and he's not able to do it. Who can do this? This person has to be worthy, has to be fit to open up the ruler's plan for history and do it, to take a grip of history and aim it precisely in its intended direction. According to John's vision, it is up to one person to bring a happy ending out of all that has been. Who can do that? The great men and women of history, what have they done? We think of the war, we think of Churchill, who influenced things in an incredible way, who pushed things in a direction that maybe they wouldn't have gone otherwise. But it's one thing. It's one thing to influence things, to push them, to prod them in directions. But to grasp history itself and turn it all around. Men make history, but they do not make the history that they choose. This task is unimaginable. There is no one who can do it. So no surprise, verse 3. But no one in heaven or on earth or under the earth could open the scroll or even look inside it. No one. No one anywhere. It is unimaginable that someone could be found to do this job. In fact, the only thing more unimaginable is the idea that the job would never be done. The meaning would never be accessible. The drama would never be resolved. That thought leads John to weep. The saddest sound, verse 4, I wept and wept because no one was found who was worthy. And John's weeping, I think, stands for the weeping of the world. Every story that we read goes through a kind of fairly predictable pattern. You start, you're introduced to the characters, then there's a dark period, a moment of crisis, a climax and a resolution. This is like the great script of history is stuck at the dark moment, is stuck at the weeping. How far would we have to go from Odd Down Community Centre right now to find someone weeping? I imagine not very far. How far do you think we would have to go? Apart from Bethany. A mile? Do you think there's probably a mile, someone weeping within a mile of this building? I reckon so. Multiply that by the size of the world. It is a tear-drenched globe. And John weeps at the thought that this is where we might be stuck. That the job will never be done, that history will never be resolved. And if that is the case, we should weep with him, because the tears will never end. John weeps because he knows that no one in humanity is worthy of this. No one can do it. It is not a solution we can achieve. Did the war to end all wars end all wars? Did any of the great men and women of history actually solve the problem? Or are they not part of it? No one can end war. No one can end the tears. They will go on. But, verse 5. Then one of the elders said to me, "Do not weep." Do not weep. As big as the job is, there is someone who can do it. There is someone who can do it. Verse 5. Do not weep. See, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the Root of David, has triumphed. He is able to open the scroll and its seven seals. These are New Testament names for Jesus, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, but they're from the Old Testament. The Bible's one book, one story. Old and New Testament tell one story, one realistic story, which includes plenty of weeping, all the varieties of sadness and the causes of tears you can imagine. The weeping starts after just a few pages of this long book. And that whole story as well is focused on a person. The idea that a person will come to turn everything right. And the story progresses through thousands of years, showing us in a thousand different ways what this person must be like. Lion of Judah and Root of David are pointers back to Old Testament explanations of what this person should be. He must be a king, like King David. He will be a lion, a strong leader. He will be the one to open the scroll, to reveal the contents, to do the ruler's will for history. Not only is he capable in this vision, he has triumphed already, verse 5. He has triumphed. Now that is what John is told. But when he sees him, it is the funniest kind of lion that must have won the strangest kind of victory. And at this point, the juniors are going to go out and think a bit more about what we've been looking at. The strangest victory. John hears in verse 5 about a lion, but in verse 6, when he looks, he sees a lamb. He's told about a lion who has triumphed, and when he looks, verse 6, he sees a lamb who's been killed. How is this figure fit to do the job of all jobs? How is being killed a victory? And yet, in John's vision, it is being slain that makes him worthy. It's not that he fought a victorious battle, but sadly he was killed in the process. No, dying was his victory. Glance down to verse 9. They sing this song saying, "You are worthy." Why is he worthy? To take the scroll and open its seals. "Because you were slain. And with your blood, with your death, you purchased for God persons from every tribe and language and people and nation." The lamb's victory is that his death bought something. We can understand that sacrifice sometimes brings us good. Those young men on the battlefields of France, their blood purchased freedom for our nation. Jesus' death on the cross, his blood purchased freedom for people. Not just one nation, but people from every tribe and language and people and nation. Anyone and everyone who will accept it. And verse 10, "You've made them to be a kingdom and priests to serve our God, and they will reign on the earth." They've been made new. They've been given a hope and a future. And Revelation later explains what that future will look like. It says God himself will wipe every tear away. That is the intended destination of history. That is where the ruler's great plan is supposed to end. And what stops us from getting there, what has halted us in the veil of tears, is us. We don't fit with the good ending picture. We have broken the ruler's law. We have chosen evil. Those tears within a mile of this building, how many of them will be caused by the behavior of other human beings? It was not God who brought tears into the world. It was us. It is us still. And because there is a law, because there is good and evil, because there's a just ruler who cares, getting rid of the tears looks like getting rid of us. How could good remain good if God did not oppose evil, even in me? And that is where the lion, who looks like a lamb, has won the victory. Jesus' death on the cross was a satisfaction of justice. It was God saying an eternal yes to good and no to evil, but without saying an eternal no to us. His blood, his taking the punishment and the consequences means that his people can be freed and the good ending can become reality. Jesus is worthy to open it because he has won this victory and purchased a people to be there when God wipes all tears away. Don't weep, John. There is someone worthy. And because there is, one day all the weeping will stop. And so, verse 7, he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who sat on the throne. It has been done. He has taken it. And do you notice back up in verse 6 where he was when he took the scroll? The Lamb, I saw a lamb looking at as if it had been slain, standing at the centre of the throne. He is there on the throne. The Lamb had seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. A little bit confusing, but it's just more symbol language. Seven horns, all strength. Seven eyes, all knowing. Seven spirits, all presence. This lion-lamb figure has got all the power and authority and presence of God himself. And he's there, standing at the centre of the throne. It's Jesus who configures our view of God himself. He is at the centre of the throne. We look at God, the ruler of the universe, through the lens of Jesus, the lion and the slain lamb. Reconfigures our view of strength itself. We think of strength as only a force that crushes, but the strong lion here is the lamb who lays down his life for others, and that is his victory. It's the slain lamb on the throne, the God who in the person of Jesus shed his own blood for his people. When we're wondering how that script for history can possibly include all the horrors that were seen 100 years ago and through the years to this day, we think, how can that be? How can they be part of his plan? How can they be written into it? Well, until we read it all, no. But what we do know is this. What John does see is this. The one who wrote it made the shedding of his own blood for our sake the central act. He is worthy. And so the result that John sees is the sweetest song. Verse 9, they sang a new song saying, "You are worthy to take the scroll. You are worthy." Verse 11, then he looked and heard the voice of many angels, numbering 10,000 upon thousands and 10,000 times 10,000. They encircled the throne and the living creatures and the elders. In a loud voice they were saying, "Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and strength and glory and honour and praise." Then I heard every creature in heaven and on earth and under the earth and on the sea and all that is in them saying, "To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb be praise and honour and glory and power forever and ever." The four living creatures said, "Amen." And the elders fell down and worshipped. It's a song of worship. Worship to the one who has answered John's weeping, who has answered our weeping. Worship to the one who came and shared in our tears, who cried himself at our sorrows, and who by his death won the victory that means they can be ended. There's no sweeter song than the song that tells of the Lion of Judah who is worthy. This is worship. This is worship. This is what worship is. I guess most people today don't feel like they need to worship anything. Maybe that's because they've never seen anyone worthy of worship. If you do see someone worthy, worship is joy. But if you don't, of course it makes no sense. I want to read to you something that Katie picked up at an art gallery the other week. Someone has written a hymn. A hymn in praise of renewal for the new immortals. Listen to this. It's patterned on Charles Wesley's Over a Thousand Tongues. Praise to the wonder of science's code, to end mortality, replace the failing cells, no aging for the old, trust in technology. Hear now the deaf with implants hit clear, no more the clouded lens. Raise up the paralyzed, their shattered spines repair, and they can walk again. Now break the power of cancer's hold, disease and pain defeat. Reprogram DNA, the miracles unfold, the rampant cells retreat. Soft cells and skin and bone we engineer, the seeds on scaffolds sown. Remake the building blocks, protect the telomeres, our mortal form disown. Tissues and organs regenerate, renew the beating heart, resuscitate the dead. Each one rejuvenate, no more will we depart. Oh, for 1,000 tongues to sing, new life the dead receive. Cast off the fear of death, salvation we will bring, in science we believe. That's a fascinating composition. He's trying to replace a song of worship to God with a song about science. It's asking the question very successfully, I think, are the accomplishments of science sufficient objects of worship? I wonder what you think. I think it's an utter failure. I think it's an utter success at asking the question and an utter failure to show that they are. It completely exposes them. They're wonderful and good things in themselves, but they're pathetic objects of worship. On the one hand, most of the things it mentions aren't really possible. They're not within the capabilities of current science. And even if they were, what tiny percentage of the world's population could access them would be wealthy enough. I'd be a foolish person who bet against science in the sense of seeing wonders. What things have we seen in the past 100 years? What incredible things will we see in the next 100 years? But even if it did everything it said in that hymn, would it stop us hurting? Would it stop us fighting? Would it give meaning and purpose to life? Would it stop the crying? I think it is pale and it is thin when you compare it with Wesley's original hymn, which you can do because it's there on your song sheet and we'll sing it in a minute. Because the wonders of science aren't objects of worship, as wonderful and as awe-inspiring and as grateful as we can be for them, they're not worthy of worship. They're tools that can be used for evil as well as good. You can't replace a person with a concept. Science can take away all kinds of sadness, but it cannot give joy and it cannot be loved. It is not worthy of that. You note in Wesley's hymn, it is not what Jesus does for us that we worship. It is Jesus that we worship. It's not life and health and peace, though we're gloriously thankful that he brings those to us. It is him. It's not the glories of our restored bodies that we sing about. It is the glories of my God and King. Science is a wonderful, inspiring gift of God, but it is a pathetic object of worship. It is not worthy, but he is. He is worthy of singing about and singing to. He only is worthy to be worshipped. That's the vision John is given, and that's the most important question for every one of us this week. Is he worthy? Is he worthy? That is the question we seek to share and put in front of everyone we meet. Is he worthy? That's the question you've been seeking to put in front of people this main event week at the university, isn't it? For those who are not following Jesus, look at this. Look at this man. Does this vision of reality ring true to you? Does this explain the way things are and history? And most importantly, what do you think of Jesus? This is the most important question for us if we're Christians as well. Each day, in the way we live, in the 1,000 decisions we make, big and small, is he worthy? When we're faced with the questions, which internet sites will I click on? With what tone of voice will I speak to my children? What or who am I going to fix my heart's longing on this week? The question behind those questions is he worthy of all praise and honor and glory in my life today. Is he worthy? Is he worthy when we're crying, when we're weeping because the world is broken? Will we despair? Will we fix our hopes on the weekend, the holiday, the change in situation, or on him? Well, is he worthy? Is he worthy to take the scroll and open it? Is he worthy such that he will bring us to the point where tears will be wiped away for good? Is he worthy? Is he worthy when we're serving? And we're serving him and we feel tired and we just wish it could stop. It feels like 1 hour too many at the main event week or running the Christianity Explored course. It feels like we must be committing too much when we're standing up at work or at school and not joining in the things we know we shouldn't join in with and trying to speak the gospel words again. Is it worth it? Well, the question is he worthy? That's the question. And the answer that needs to be front and center every moment this week. Is he worthy? He is. He is. That's the question and answer we long to put in front of people. Because we long them to be able to share this sweet song with us. Not primarily, is Christianity rational? Although it is, and we should show people that. Not does it make sense of right and wrong? Though it does, and we should show people that. Not do Christianity and science fit together? Though they do, and we should show people that. Not does it give you the most satisfying life? Though it does, and we should show people that. But this, is he worthy? Is Jesus Christ worthy of your worship? Because this is who he is. This is what he has done. Not just a concept or even a worldview, but a person. This person. Is he worthy? If he is not, then there is no point in poetry and music and speech and love. There is nothing but mud and silence. And we might as well learn to weep because there is nothing else. But if he is, even though we haven't reached the happy ending, even though our tears are still here, they've not yet been wiped away, our song is sweet because it is about him. And he is worthy. Is he worthy? He is.